right, I think we can start our briefing today. Today is the 21st of November, and welcome to this press briefing at the UN office at Geneva, hosted by the UN Information Service. Once again, another busy brief, a very important brief. We have three colleagues who will address the situation in Gaza. On my right, you know Ricardo Well from UNICEF, who will be speaking momentarily, but we'll first connect with colleagues who are joining us remotely. Tarek is online as well from WHO. We have Rick Peppercorn, who you know very well, who's WHO's representative in the occupied Palestinian territory, who's joining us from Jerusalem. And then we have Abira Tefa, who's with the World Food Program, who you know as well, and she is going to introduce a guest, Martin Penner, who's joining us from Gaza. So without further ado, I don't know, Tarek, did you want to start off, or can we go right to Rick?
Okay. Hold on.
Give it a second.
Thank you very much, Rolando. Rick has just dialed in, so we can start immediately with him.
Okay, so we'll go to the Rick second. Okay, that's what, if I understood that correctly. Okay, in that case, Abir, who's joining us from Cairo, again, senior spokesperson for the World Food Program. Thanks for joining us, Abir. Do we have a beer?
Yep.
Unmute, start my video. I think I'm ready now.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone, and nice to talk to everyone again. So let me give you today the latest that we have on the situation on the ground in Gaza. And I'm going to be joined in this briefing with my colleague, Martin Penner, who is the head of communications for WFP in Palestine, and he's currently in Gaza. He's going to give you eyewitness account of what he's seeing on the ground. So, as you've briefed, I think we've seen in the briefing in the last few days that Gaza was facing heavy rain and falling temperature last week, which caused more misery for families living in tents and damaged buildings. The flood waters spoiled and washed away food and supplies that many families were storing. Overflowing sewage also increased the risk of disease. It was a taste of what is going to face these families in the coming winter, which threatens to be very rough for families who've lived through 2 years of war and have little left to face another winter in the open. Hundreds of thousands of people remain in urgent need of food assistance. Most are displaced. Food systems have completely been shattered. So the access to basic necessities is still limited, and the rain made it worse. So let me move into food assistance. So and update on WFP operations. Since the ceasefire started on the 10th of October, WFP has brought over 40,000 tons of food assistance into Gaza. That's from the 10th of October until the 19th of November. That works out at around two-thirds of our monthly target. We now have 54 distribution points operational across Gaza, 17 of them in the north. And we've reached around 530,000 people with food parcels. Again, that's 30% of our monthly target of the 1.6 million people. WFP supported bakeries are now operational, around 18, nine of them in the north. And they are producing around 160,000 bread bundles per day that meets our daily targets. The bread is distributed through more than 430 points across Gaza. We are also, glad to say that hot meals are back and these kitchens are operating again in Gaza, 13 in the south, 12 in the middle, and 11 in the north. So they are producing around 200,000 meals every day. The target is still 400,000. A lot of people don't have access to cooking facilities, and it's very important that we keep these hot kitchens, hot meals kitchens going, especially in light of the upcoming winter. Again, the digital cash assistance have reached around 125,000 people. That's still half of our November target. And it's very important to get the cash assistance going, because with prices falling and dropping since the ceasefire, this is an ideal time to scale up cash support so families can access fresh food and other essentials. In terms of winter preparedness, the WFP-led logistics cluster is facilitating transport of tents, blankets, wash stations, and mattresses for humanitarian partners to distribute ahead of winter. WFP is also providing sacks to be used as sandbags to protect camps from flood water. The challenges still persist. Logistic challenges remain. Closure of key road arteries in Gaza the last few weeks has been a significant constraint on cargo movements from Kerem Shalom, causing congestion and insecurity around convoys. The damage to infrastructure during the conflict has severely impacted warehousing and storage capacity. It's an issue for our operations. We need full access to all crossings and routes into Gaza so we can bring in the volume of aid needed. And we welcome the opening of the northern crossing at Zikim for humanitarian assistance, which is urgently needed for the population in the north of Gaza, that region that suffered the most severe hunger during the war. In conclusion, I think the immediate focus is on expanding food assistance while gradually extending the cash support and strengthening the efforts to get Gaza's private sector back on its feet. Gaza needs the ceasefire to hold, and with full implementation of the ceasefire and full humanitarian access, we can operate at the scale needed for a crisis of this magnitude. With this, I hand it over to Martin, who is on the ground in Gaza, to just give you a bit of color of what he's seeing on the ground. Over to Martin.
Good morning, everybody. Very happy to be here. So what is the mood like on the ground in Gaza at the moment? Well, WFP staff here in Gaza spend every day out in the field at distributions, talking to people. And there are a few themes that keep recurring in the conversations that we're having. The first is the uncertainty. The joy and relief that was there when the ceasefire was announced has now been replaced by worries about very concrete, practical realities of life. What comes next? Will the ceasefire hold? Can we rebuild? How long will it take? Will we be able to feed our families? Hope is still there in the background, but it's very evident to most people that it's going to be a long road to recovery. You know, after the ceasefire, people were expecting something to happen, expecting to see some visible improvement in their situation, and things are improving, but not fast enough for the families that we speak to. The next theme, as Abir mentioned just then, the next theme is the winter. People are worried about the winter. The heavy rains earlier this week really were a reminder of how fragile most families in Gaza still are. The makeshift tents that they're living in are barely holding up, and when you get the wind and the rain, they sometimes don't. So soaked mattresses and belongings exposed to the elements, food and stores washed away or spoiled, it really focused minds on the coming winter and the bad weather that must be endured in the months ahead. And then the third theme is food, of course, the thing that my agency is primarily concerned with. Markets are coming back to life, food is there, but prices are still out of reach for most people. A chicken costs $25, a kilo of meat, $20. So many people still rely on food aid, food parcels, bread from bakeries, hot meals kitchens. One woman told us that she feels like her whole body is crying out for different kinds of food, different from the canned food and the dry rations that people have been living on for 2 years. Basically a diet with fresh food, fruit, vegetables, meat, dairy, eggs. These things are on the markets, but as I say, most people can't afford them. They don't have income or a job, so they can't afford what's there. A woman we met in Khan Yunis said that she doesn't take her children to the market so that they won't see all the food that's available, but that they can't afford. If they go near the market, she tells them to cover their eyes. Another woman in the same town said she buys one apple and divides it between her four children. Better than nothing. This, by the way, as Abir said, is why WFP is increasing its digital payments program. We provide the support so that the families that are really struggling can actually buy some of the food on the markets. So the short version of all of that is that things are better than before the ceasefire, but we have a long way to go. And sustained support is as important as ever to help families rebuild their health, their nutrition, their livelihoods, and their lives. Thanks very much.
Thanks to you both, Abir and Martin. Thanks very much for joining us here. I'm going to throw now to Rick Peppercorn, who you know well, WHO's representative in the OPT, joining us from Jerusalem, if I'm not mistaken. Rick, over to you.
Thank you very much, Tarek. Let me first start that although there's a ceasefire, people still get killed. The Ministry of Health reported 266 Gazans killed, 634 injured, in addition to 548 bodies recovered from under the rubble since the ceasefire. Looking at healthcare availability, the needs remain immense compared to the healthcare availability. Half 18 of the 36 hospitals partly functional, 82 of the 194 primary healthcare and medical points partly functional, and then there's an addition on the number of field hospitals partly functional. 7 of the 36 hospitals are located what we call beyond the ceasefire line, beyond the so-called yellow line, 2 in Khan Yunis, 2 in North Gaza, and 3 in Rafah. 2 of those, Bayt Hanun and Kuwait, a specialized hospital destroyed, or the remaining are heavily damaged or inaccessible beyond the yellow line. What happened since ceasefire? That's, we get a question also. So what happened with regard to health, for example, on early recovery and relief, and talking about health functionality? So 26 health service points have reopened. 4 hospitals, 8 medical points, and 6 primary healthcare centers. I want to stress all partially functional. 8 health service points newly established, medical points, and 7 primary healthcare centers. Of the newly functional hospitals, WHO is working on the renovation of pediatric intensive care unit and a neonatal intensive care unit at Rantisi Hospital to expand neonatal care. There are no functional hospitals in North Gaza. Estimated 20,000 plus people are there. 12 hospitals are currently partly functional in the Greater Gaza City, providing service to vulnerable population in Gaza and North Gaza. The services in North services are partially supported by the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, Jabalia, supported by WHO and 2 medical points. So what also WHO in part is trying to do is to establish a primary healthcare centers in the courtyard of Kamal Adwan in North Gaza, former pediatric hospital destroyed last year. But for today, for the second time, we were denied access to reach the hospitals with supplies, delaying operations and delaying, I mean, to make sure that at least a PHC center can be partly functional. Shifa, WHO working up to setting up a desalination plant to serve the hemodialysis units. It's the only hemodialysis units in serving in Gaza, North Gaza, 165 patients versus 32 machines. So expected to reach around 300 patients. Currently, 4 out of 32 dialysis machines are out of order. We also plan a 120-bed extension in Shifa to increase the capacity. The access to European Gaza Hospital, we reported there on the part, is just behind the yellow line on the other, on the east side of Saladin, continues to be denied. This is potentially an important referral hospital. So WHO and parts need access to transfer also the critical cardio equipment, which is still there, which is needed for urgent use in other hospitals. WHO supported Al Khair Hospital Khan Yunis, which became partly functional again following the attacks in February 24, and also established, we established a 20-bed nutrition stabilization center for the hospital to provide inpatient care for children. And already we talk about 825 admissions to this so-called severely acute malnourished stabilization center. I want to say something general on health functionality. There is a well-documented and I would say a very focused strategic plan from the Palestinian Authority for early recovery, rehabilitation, and reconstruction. When you look at health, it's very pragmatic. It focuses, if you would focus from top down on the health sectors, it talks first about that there should be at least three level three hospitals in all of Gaza, one in the north, center, and the south. A group of general hospitals around that, and then most important, a network of primary healthcare facilities, 70 plus. And when you calculate a primary healthcare center, a level three or level four for each 30,000 population, those hospitals and primary healthcare centers should, of course, become fully functional. That is the aim. The UN, WHO, we are very complementary to this plan and focusing along the way. Initially, there will be also need for mobile units and of course, prefabs. We struggle, I just want to mention that as well, we struggle to get those prefabs in. We haven't managed to get that. Let me go to supplies. So since the ceasefire began, WHO have brought in more than 2,050 pallets of medical supplies, including for the key health partners as well. WHO brings them in from Kerem Shalom. The Zikim border has just reopened, as you know. We hope that this will also be functioning for medical supplies as well. We still notice that moving supplies from the West Bank to Gaza remains extremely challenging due to complex procedures and permissions, delaying the WHO ability to move the stocks, and also for infection prevention and control and essential supplies, including our supplies from Jordan, et cetera, still not coming in, including a prefab. The Saladin road is blocked and the coastal road needs to be taken for all missions, which caused a lot of delays. And I would say also a risk for exposure to looting, unnecessary. Ministry of Health reports that 343 out of the 622 essential drugs, 55% are currently at zero stock levels, includes 74% of chemotherapy and blood disease drugs, 64% of the primary healthcare drugs as well, and 56% of drugs, essential medicines related to mother and child health. Medical consumables, also to a large extent, 60-70% at close to zero stock level. We continue to call for all crossings and routes to be opened and that we can scale up the operations and supplies. You might have heard about the immunization campaign, a catch-up immunization campaign in the concluded yesterday. There will be more catch-up campaigns between 9 and 20 November. More than 30,700 children are vaccinated, led by UNICEF, UNRWA, WHO and partners, the collaboration with the Ministry of Health, supported by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. Of the children who participated, less than 2% had never received any vaccines, reflecting, and that's a positive, the huge health awareness among Palestinian families, even under extreme difficult circumstances. We also noticed that with the polio campaigns, you might remember during the wartime, a quarter of all children who visit the vaccination point has begun their routine vaccination, but missed some due to the later scheduled doses for the entire vaccine series. So we need to highlight the importance for the catch-up efforts. Also, the campaign integrated malnutrition. And of the 6,827 children screened, over 508 children were identified as acutely malnourished and referred to the nearest nutrition facility for treatment. Preparations are underway for future rounds 2 and 3 to ensure that children have received the necessary vaccine doses. What, of course, should really happen, fully functioning primary healthcare centers, where children regularly, parents will bring their children for vaccinations as it used to be, including the routine growth monitoring. The last point, medevac. So over 8,000 patients now have been medevaced out of Gaza, 8,025, including 5,562 children to over 30 countries. Still over 16,500 patients, including an estimated 4,000 children, still need medical evacuation outside the Gaza Strip. So what we continue to call for more countries to show solidarity with patients in urgent need for specialized care outside Gaza and for the opening of all evacuation corridors, medical evacuation corridors, especially to the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, which is, as we all know, the most cost-effective route to the hospitals, which are ready to receive many more patients. That would really make a difference. So to make it very clear, WHO is ready to medevac every day. We need more countries to receive critical patients, and we need the West Bank and the East Jerusalem hospital and the corridor to open now. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Rick, and thanks, Tarek, for sending the notes. Staying on the subject of children, I'm going to throw it out to Ricardo of UNICEF.
Thanks, Rolando. Good morning. Bonjour. Let me start welcoming that the Civil Military Coordination Center, the CMCC, has facilitated custom clearance and together with Israeli authorities allowed 1.6 million syringes to be dispatched to Gaza, essential items for an ongoing vaccination campaign, as mentioned by Rick. The first round finished yesterday with over 13,000 children vaccinated. We hope other pending supplies that have been awaiting custom clearance for several months will also be released for entry into Gaza by the authorities at the earliest opportunity. Turning now to recent events in Gaza, yesterday morning, a baby girl was reportedly killed in Khan Yunis by an airstrike, while the day before, seven children were killed in Gaza City and the south. This is during an agreed ceasefire. The pattern is staggering. Since 11th of October, while the ceasefire has been in effect, at least 67 children have been killed in conflict-related incidents in the Gaza Strip. Dozens more have been injured. That is an average of almost two children killed every day since the ceasefire took effect and the agreement that the killing would stop was finally achieved. As we have repeated many times, these are not statistics. Each was a child with a family, a dream, a life suddenly cut short by continued violence. Our colleagues in Gaza describe what they see every day, from children sleeping in the open and living with amputations to children orphaned and trembling in fear while living in flooded makeshift shelters, stripped of their dignity. I saw this myself when I was last there in August. The reality imposed on Gaza's children remains brutally simple. There is no safe place for them, and the world cannot continue to normalize their suffering. UNICEF is responding at scale in Gaza, but it's still not enough. We could do a lot more if the aid, and the aid that is really needed, was entering faster. The stakes are incredibly high, especially for the entry of winter and shelter supplies. For hundreds of thousands of children living in tents or the rubble of their former homes, the new season is a threat multiplier. Children are shivering through the night with no heating, no insulation, and too few blankets. Respiratory infections are on the rise, while contaminated water fuels the spread of diarrhea. Storms tear apart what little protection families have left, and children continue to clamber over broken rubble barefoot. On Wednesday, 66-year-old Taim, who has a heart issue, got new boots and winter clothes from UNICEF. His mother is still waiting for the same for his three siblings. At the same time, Gaza's doctors tell us of children they know how to save but cannot. Children with severe burns, shrapnel wounds, spinal injuries, traumatic brain injuries. Children with cancer who have lost months of treatment. Premature babies who need intensive care. Children who need surgeries that simply cannot be done inside Gaza today. For many of these children, safe, fast, and predictable medical evacuations are the difference between life and death. and between recovery and lifelong disability. Right now, around 4,000 children are still awaiting for urgent medical evacuations, including two-year-old Omima, whose heart is failing because of a congenital issue doctors in Gaza cannot treat. She needs surgery urgently to save her life. Children who require specialized urgent care not available in the Gaza Strip must, with their caregivers, be evacuated swiftly and at scale, with firm guarantees that both patients and their caregivers will be allowed to return to Gaza once treated. As a first option, the medical corridor to the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, should be restored so children can be treated there. We also urge member states to accept more children for medical treatment. Finally, yesterday, we celebrated World Children's Day, a reminder that children's rights are not abstract. A child's right to life is measured in whether they survive the night. A child's right to health is measured in whether they can reach a functioning hospital. A child's right to protection is measured in whether the cold or hunger or another strike takes them before help arrives. Too many children have already paid the highest price. Too many are still paying it, even under a ceasefire. The world promised them it would stop and we would protect them. Now we must act like it. Thank you.
Thanks, Ricardo. Hard to hear heartbreaking stories like this, but let's face it, colleagues, this is also a reminder how fragile the ceasefire is and that it really must hold. So thank you, all briefers. Now we'll throw over to you for questions, colleagues, starting in the room, if any. Yes, Olivia, Reuters.
Thank you very much, everybody, for your contributions. A few questions, if I may. If I could just start actually back with the World Food Food Programme. There was a mention about the target for food parcels. Currently, only 30% of that monthly target has been met. If you could just outline why that is. And also, in terms of food parcels, I recall a mention of some food parcels being lower in the rationing. I was just wondering if that is still the case. Some details would be helpful on that. Dr. Peppercorn, if I may, just on the medical situation, you mentioned about medical evacuations. Also, we heard there just about patients still incurring injuries from conflict-related incidents. I'm just wondering, the UAE Field Hospital, is that receiving patients? I know you've mentioned a lot of hospitals that are partially functional, but the United Arab Emirates one, is that currently receiving patients, be it injured, or are they helping in any way with medical evacuations? Are any going through that hospital? And finally, if I may, Ricardo, thank you for that contribution. Just any more details on the child, the baby girl killed yesterday in Khan Yunis? Just checking, you said it was an airstrike. And just in general, if you have any details on where most child patients are being treated in Gaza, would be helpful. And maybe Dr. Peppercorn might add on that too. Thank you all.
Thanks, Olivia. Lots of important questions there. So we'll start off with WFP. I don't know, Abir or Martin, who want to tackle those early questions.
I'll pass this over to Martin.
Okay, go ahead. Thanks, Martin. Over to you.
Thanks, Abir. Yes, so on the food parcels, at the beginning of the month, we did have some problems getting supplies, sufficient supplies into our warehouses to for these food boxes that we give out at the distributions. Recently, that's been going better, so I would say it's not so much a problem, and we are starting to catch up. I hope we'll get to our target this month, but in the last week or so, it's been going better. You also asked about how big a ration, because yes, as you rightly said, to begin with, we were only able to give, say, about a third of a full ration because of we didn't have enough supplies in place. At the moment, we're up to about 75% rations, so we're getting there. Thanks.
Thank you, Martin. Rick, on the medevacs in the UAE hospital.
Yeah, thank you very much. The UAE hospital is is very much outside what's called the red zone. So it's very much in the outside the yellow line. So there's no access to that for, let's say, no proper access for patients, and definitely not for a medevac. And let me also say something about these patients and medevac. We have seen over time, there's more than 8,000 patients since October 23. So more than half of that is very much trauma related. And my we've raised many times, my UNICEF colleague was raising it as well. And from the 8,000 patients, that's actually the word, over 5,000 children were referred. And over half of that was very much related to trauma. And it is related to amputations, extensive burns, spinal injuries, et cetera, et cetera. Children who need, children and adults who need multiple operations, et cetera, to recover, and a lot of rehabilitation. But I also want to get back, and we raised it so many times, that before this crisis exploded, that between 50 to 100 patients per day were referred to the West Bank and East Jerusalem hospitals. That's mainly not for trauma. That was mainly for what we call non-communicable diseases. And 40% of that was related to cancer, oncology, of children, adults, etc. And the other were groups were complex cardiovascular diseases, complex diabetes, etc. And we see this now as well. And if you talk about the impact of non-communicable diseases in Gaza, we see the lack of treatment of diagnostic services affected cancer patients, limited treatment on the three facilities. And in the cluster, it's only in Al-Razi, Alu, and Nasser, limited. Critical medical shortages in that area also affected the access of diabetic patients. And according to the data, there's over 71,000 people living with diabetes in Gaza. I just mentioned that. And it includes 20 to 30% who require approximately 25,000 vials of insulin per month and related supply. And WHO, we've been shipping in these vials, but too small fraction from WHO on this partner. So this is just a few. And then I'm not even talking about patients who should be medevacs. My last point I want to raise also related to diseases, and I think my UNICEF colleague also referred to that. You talk about infectious diseases. We see with winter coming, we've always seen an huge increase in acute respiratory infections in Gaza over this whole crisis, including, of course, acute watery diarrhea. And they remain the most reported conditions. We expect with winter, and we have had already some really bad rains to come, that this will further increase. And it's accounting, I mean, only those two on the children, the for morbidity of 64% and 36%, and a mild increase in this acute watery diarrhea morbidity of the children over 5 years of age has been observed. So this is also something we, and it's everything to do with the environment, the lack of proper shelter, the lack of proper water and sanitation, etc. And then, of course, the partly functional health system, which we have to make fully functional again. Over to you.
Thanks, Rick. Ricardo.
Yeah, so on the issue of the baby girl that was killed, we don't have a lot of details. We know that she was killed in the residence in Bani Suheila, which is Easter Khan Yunis, with her parents. So the Israeli strike came in that in their residence and killed her and her two parents. As far as the children being treated with injuries, I mean, you heard from Rick how challenging the situation is on the medical front, but mostly these children are being brought to Nasser Hospital or Shifa Hospital, Al Ahli Hospital, and Al Aqsa. These are the main ones that are receiving children with severe injuries.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, colleagues. We'll go online unless. Oh yes, Alexandre, AFP.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, just two questions. Maybe one for Marin. Regarding the bombings that occurred yesterday and the day before, can you tell us how did it affect your work and your teams a little bit in detail? And second, for Ricardo, about the figure of 67 children killed since the October 11, can you tell us which was your source of the figure, please?
Okay, thanks very much. Martin, on the first part of the question.
So far, we didn't feel too much in the way of impact on our operations. Obviously, we're aware of these events, and obviously we were being very vigilant and very, very careful and sort of concerned about the future, because all of this makes operations more difficult. But for the time being, there have been no significant impact on operations.
Okay, thanks for that. Ricardo.
Yeah, the source, it's important to clarify, so thank you for your question. These are reported figures. They are not verified in the UN MRM process, which takes longer, and the final verified numbers are shared with the Secretary General for his report on children and armed conflict. But we do have teams on the ground, child protection teams and partners, who are monitoring and following up on reports of grave violations. And whenever children are injured or killed, we get these reports from our partners on the ground, and therefore we share them externally.
Thanks very much. Okay, we'll go online now. We have a few questions. Gabby of Proceso.
Thank you, Rolando. Thank you for taking my question. To UNICEF, we would like to see what you are describing with our own eyes. Now with the ceasefire, do you think you could organize a visit to Gaza and West Bank for the UN correspondents?
Gabi, I would love to say yes. We could organize a media visit, but the reality is the UN is not the right path to facilitate these visits right now. Journalists have to get their clearance to go in individually, independently, and once in, obviously, UNICEF can help and facilitate visits to sites, to projects, to interview and speak to locals and mothers and children who've been suffering for over 2 years after this horrible war started.
Absolutely, and as you know, colleagues, we've been advocating for this since day one, for more eyes and ears on the ground. We need you to be on the ground there, to be witnesses to these horrific stories that we hear about here. So of course, thanks to colleagues who are on the ground reporting back to us, but of course we need journalists, more journalists in the country, in the region. So thanks for that, Gabby. I'll take a question now from Iman from the Kuwait News Agency.
Thank you, Rolando. I have a question for the WFP on the food actually entering to Gaza. Many Palestinians said that the prices remain very high because the occupation forces are not allowing the entry of nutritious food. Instead, they flood the market of unhealthy product in many areas. Do you have any information about this issue, or do you observe more restriction on vegetables, fruits, eggs, and meats compared to unhealthy food? Thank you.
Thanks, Iman. Martin or Abir, perhaps? Martin?
I can come in here. I think the main issue that faces everyone, including the commercial sector, is the fact that a lot of these food supplies stay in border crossing points for long hours, for long days, and therefore, you know, the possibility of them going bad is high. And I don't necessarily know that there are restrictions on the, you know, the choice of food items going inside, but I think it is probably the self-choice of merchants and the private sector to go for items that will that has a longer shelf life. So we haven't heard that there is like restrictions on fresh supplies going in, other than the just the necessity of you know, the private sector making sure that they are getting stuff in, making profit, but and at the same time having these supplies you know, last longer because of these delays, because of the bureaucratic procedures that you face with anything that's going into Gaza.
Thanks a lot, Abir. Okay, we'll take a question from Nick, New York Times.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking the question. For Abir, please. There was a report this week saying that, I think it came from CMCC, saying that 800 trucks a day were getting into Gaza. I wonder if, what comment you might have on that number. But secondly, I wonder if you could explain exactly what CMCC's role is for you. Do you have representation in there on a daily basis? Are you negotiating access for convoys with CMCC? My understanding is that COGAT still controls the crossing points. So what in fact is the role of CMCC at the moment in terms of humanitarian assistance entering Gaza? Thank you.
Okay, let me start by your second question, which is that, you know, the coordination with the CMCC. And yes, we do. We discuss with everyone on the ground, COGAT, CMCC, and this is how we're getting our supplies and the scaling up of the operations. So the coordination is happening on the ground with both. In terms of the 800 trucks, I'm, you know, it's not all WFP and it's not all the humanitarian sector. So I'm not sure about the 800 trucks a day figure. We do have, you know, I have to get you the number of on average how many trucks go in a day. It's not what we're targeting. It's not always 800. Sometimes it is. But it's not all for WFP. I will defer to Martin in case, because he's on the ground, maybe he knows exactly how many trucks are going for WFP. But I think that the main thing is that we're getting almost two-thirds of the food supplies that we need to be in Gaza regularly. We're hoping to be able to get more, to get all the border crossings to be open so that we get into the 1.6 million that we're targeting. It's the coordination is a step in the right direction as we speak now.
Okay, thank you very much, Martin. If you have anything to add, or perhaps even Rick, Martin.
I don't have anything to add. I mean, Abir said it very well. I mean, it's not 800 every day. And at the moment, WFP is getting in somewhere between 100, around 100 a day. There's a lot of stuff going for the commercial sector and other partners. We can have a bilateral if you want to go deeper into this.
Fair enough. Thanks very much. All right. Of course, colleagues, if you have something to add, just raise your hand. Maybe Rick, I don't know if you wanted to chime in on this or.
I can maybe say something about it, because there was a question about the CMCC, et cetera. And I think it's the way, I mean, just also my own observations. I think it's a one UN. The CMCC platform is mainly used to provide information as good as possible. So what is the situation on the ground in Gaza? What was it before? What was it during, et cetera? What are the key issues, et cetera? And we do this in a way, we organize ourselves through the clusters, the cluster lead, OCHA is coordinating that. And for example, the WHO cluster coordinator is there on a daily basis. Our team in health emergencies very regularly. I've been there 4 or 5 times. And what I've done is not a little, maybe more extensive than what I do here with you, is to provide information. The first time there was a request for an overview for hospitals, but we provide an overview of the whole health sector in Gaza, the health functionalities, all the key issues, hospitals. And then we went in depth in some of the hospitals. The second one was on primary healthcare and the primary healthcare and primary healthcare facilities. And we went actually into depth and on the third and the fourth time presentations, having been there now 5 times and focusing on health. I have said, I raised already that for the UN, there's of course a concern what we see currently, and we hope that this peace process is moving forwards in that sense rapidly. But currently you see the so-called red zone and a green zone. And in the red zone, you have 2.1 million Palestinians, where we focus our support for the UN and very much in line. If we talk about a one Gaza approach and I would say a one Palestine approach. And I raised, for example, and for health again specifically, because part of that we studied that's the plan of Palestinian authorities for rehabilitation, early recovery, rehabilitation and reconstruction, etc., is in health a very focused and strategic plan to come to the most cost-effective approach for health, very much in line with because we were working together, what we were already planning and trying to be as complementary as possible. So our role currently is very much providing information as good as possible, and we hope to see, of course, more changes and more facilitation for the UN and humanitarian partners to be able to provide humanitarian, but specifically also humanitarian support, but also early recovery in a much more effective way. And I think we would like to see more more changes in that way. Over to you.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Rick. Let me go back to Nick, because I think you had a follow-up before I take the other questions. Nick?
Yeah, thank you. It's just that here we are 6 weeks after the start of a ceasefire that was supposed to open the way to kind of uninhibited deliveries of humanitarian assistance. And you're still only, WFP's only up to 2/3. WHO still has very limited medevacs going. So I'm kind of wondering what value the CMCC is really adding to this process. There still seems to be more obstruction, and it doesn't seem to be able to mitigate that. So what is it actually doing? Thank you.
I think they answered part of that, Nick, but I don't know if there is anything more you wanted to mention, either Rick or perhaps Abir or Martin. Go ahead, Rick. No, you're muted. Let's try again.
Sorry, I hope you can hear me now. So not much to add. I mean, I raised this already. So the current phase, it seems very much information sharing and provision of information. And I think the UN is doing that in an as focused way as possible and along the lines of clusters and sectors, coordinated by OCHA with all the respective UN agencies who are leading in the various areas for us, that is health, etc., and do this as focused as possible. I think it's a start, and what we all hope, of course, that we will see a much more fundamental change in the way humanitarian support and early recovery activities can start. I think that is probably also, and that's not much for me to comment on, in line with the whole peace process and everything what's happening there. And currently, There are some incremental changes. I think WFP have reported that on food, etc. But of course, much more is needed. And I think my UNICEF colleague reflected that, myself, I reflected that. And we really hope and expect that this will happen. And you mentioned the point on Medevac, etc. So we raised a lot of the same things which we raised with you, we raised there as well. We come with key asks on supplies, on Medevac, etc., etc. And we hope that we are being listened to, and we hope and we expect that some of those changes will be coming in effect sooner than later. Over to you. Over to you.
Thanks very much, Rick. I think that was very clear. Okay, a couple more questions still online. Gabby, back to you. Proceso.
Yes, thank you. My question is to WHO on the funding. Are you having problems with the departure of USA from WHO?
Okay, Rick.
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Yeah, the funding. If difficulties you may be facing given the cuts, the budget cuts, and I think did you mention Gabby specifically from the U.S.? If I heard correctly.
Yes.
Okay.
USA left WHO.
USA. Okay.
So you are having problems on that issue.
I think we have proven as WHO that from the start of this crisis exploded, that we were super operational, and we work in all areas. Essential health services as the main pillar, how to support that. And then you talk, of course, the basis, essential medicines and medical supplies, but also the Medevac, internal Medevac. Maybe you remember that, a lot of internal Medevac from hospitals from the north to the south, and then Medevac outside. Assistance of the fantastic emergency medical teams directly. And of course, all kind of other capacity building, etc., within the essential, the pillar number one, maintaining essential health services. Then we also have been extremely active in the public health intelligence and think about health information, epidemics, prevention. Think about the polio campaigns, but also the other work, what is going on, health information. And then, of course, the area of coordinating 80 partners, making sure that we try to focus the scarce resources as good as possible. And then the fourth pillar, which should be the biggest one, early recovery, which we started, and rehabilitation in a number of areas, even during the war, and we expand. So I think we have a range here of partners. We have 30 plus member states, donors that's actually investing in the WHO program. And yeah, and we have been really, I mean, from the start, very much we delivered, that was reflected, and more partners join. And we expect exactly that what we also currently planning, and at when we can help properly going to continue with the humanitarian support, which will be needed for many years, but really expand in early recovery and rehabilitation and reconstruction for health. Yeah, we expect that member states and donors will continue to invest. Over to you.
Thanks, Rick. Olivia Reuters.
Thank you. Sorry, just a couple of follow-ups, if I may. Ricardo, you might have seen that MSF put a statement out today about several people, including children, being treated on Wednesday for gunshot wounds, but also one child being shot at by a quadcopter. I was just wondering if you have any details on the seven children you said were killed, on how, whether that was airstrike, quadcopter, or if you don't maybe have that level of detail. That's my question for you. And then Dr. Peppercorn, sorry, just a clarification. On the UAE field hospital, so you're saying it's under in an area which is under Israeli control, so therefore patients inside Gaza are not taken there for treatment. So currently that means patients just in general are not being treated there, or sorry, it just wasn't clear how it's currently operating. Thank you.
Okay, Olivia, I can follow up, but I don't have details on exactly how these other seven children were killed, but I can strongly assume on strikes as well. But I can get back to you on that.
All right, thanks, Ricardo. Rick, back to you.
I addressed this already. That hospital is very much in what's called the yellow zone, etc. And there's a lack of access. So it's there's few people living in that area. And in that sense, I mean, it's we don't know beyond that. We are not moving to there. We are not doing our operations. We do the operations and invest the scarce resources where the people are. And the people are in this so-called red zone. The 2.1 million Gazans are there. And that's where we're focusing. We hope that soon we can properly continue in an al-Gaza approach. And people can move back to the areas where they live and come from, etc. And then that might change. Over to you.
Okay, thanks again, Rick. Okay, we'll take the last two questions because we have to move on. We still have Ukraine on the agenda. John Zarakostas, and then back to Iman. John of France 24 and The Lancet.
Good morning, Rick. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more. Earlier this week, we had the Security Council endorsed plan. How do you see that plan factoring in on health, given that the Palestinian Authority are not front and center in that resolution?
Okay, go ahead, Rick. Yep.
All right, I think maybe it's more of a question for you than for me in that sense. I mean, like, you know, we, of course, as a one UN, we focus on a one Gaza approach and one Palestine approach and the whole road to a two-state solution, etc. And that is also, by the way, I didn't say that about the CMCC. Unfortunately, there's not yet Palestinian participation, which you would expect and you would hope for. So that's another thing which is definitely being raised. And John, I think when I look at the overall, let's say the overall plan of the PA, and I'm specifically focused on health, I think it's a very pragmatic and a strategic plan. And as I said, it's not about, oh, we are immediately going to rebuild 36 hospitals, which were there. They make a real choice that, hey, we need a level 3 hospital in the north, one in the center and the south. We need a group of general hospitals around there. And we need, most importantly, a proper primary healthcare network with community links and based on packages. And I think that is very much in line with our plans and our thinking, etc. And this is already what we are trying to do, what we constantly try to do. And how do we make sure that and initially there will be indeed additional relief operations, and you will need prefab structures to, for example, for key primary healthcare centers which are destroyed, and hospitals and hospitals which are destroyed, for example, think Shifa, you will need a few prefab structures to continue the work, and in the meantime you can think about a larger reconstruction. That also applies, and that's a varied approach depending on the level of destruction and yeah, on the destroyment. And then there might be initially also need for some mobile teams, etc. There are plans in place, and I really hope that we will be able to help implement these plans.
Very much so. Thank you, Rick. And maybe just to add, of course, I'll repeat what we've said earlier this week upon the adoption of this resolution, John, to your question. Of course, this is a path forward. It's theoretical. What we need is concrete action, the type of action that we've been advocating for months and months and months. So indeed, there is a fragile ceasefire in place. We've heard all sorts of horror stories since the ceasefire. It's an earlier ceasefire, but what we need is just to be actualized and lasting peace, stability, and peace for the people in the region. So let's take maybe the last question, unless there's one in the room. Okay, so let me just take the question from Iman, Kuwait News Agency.
Thank you so much. I have just a small clarification from Ricardo, and I'm sorry to ask this banalistic question, but I should to be really clear in my reporting. When you said at least 67 children have been killed in conflict-related incident, do you mean the Israeli airstrike? Israeli strikes in general? Thank you.
So if I understand, you were asking the attribution of the strikes, correct?
Yes.
Yes, I mean, these were, there's only one party to the conflict in Gaza with the firepower to do airstrikes. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay. Ricardo, thank you very much. Rick, thank you so much, as always. Abir and Martin, thank you very much for joining us with these very important briefs for our journalists here. Wish you luck, and thanks very much for all the important work you're doing. Okay, colleagues, shifting to Ukraine, Jens is on the podium here from OCHA with a humanitarian update on the situation in Ukraine. Jens.
Thanks, Rolando. Happy Friday, everyone. We are 3 minutes over time, so I will do this as briefly as I can. As you saw, OCHA briefed the Security Council last night on Ukraine, and I wanted to reinforce some of our humanitarian points because the damage and death inflicted by the Russian attacks are truly horrific. If anyone is still under the impression that there are safe places in Ukraine, the air attack sirens that goes off anywhere at any time will tell you that the opposite is true. Relentless Russian missile and drone strikes kill and injure civilians every week and destroy homes and schools, hospitals and energy systems. The situation is most acute in frontline communities. Let me mention some examples. In Pokrovsk, Amirnohrad in the east, flashpoints in this war, some 1,500, mostly older people and people with limited mobility, are trapped without reliable water, power, let alone medical care. In Liman, some 100 kilometers further north, in Donetsk, around 3,000 people are out of reach of humanitarian assistance altogether due to ongoing fighting. 2 days ago, on Wednesday night, a World Food Program warehouse in Dnipro was damaged during a drone attack on the city. At least 10,000 food boxes, all intended for those civilians living close to the front lines, were destroyed. That is food families were counting on as winter sets in. And earlier this week, a wave of attacks claimed at least 20 civilian lives and left over 100 injured, including children. In October, a children's hospital in Kherson was struck, injuring civilians and medical staff. Children remain among the most exposed in this war. Many have been displaced multiple times. Others are living near active hostilities or have seen their schools, homes, or clinics damaged. They no longer have a safe place to play, to sleep, or to learn. In October, we also saw a UN-led aid convoys attacked in Kherson while trying to reach a community in need. Nationwide, frequent power cuts are depriving families of heat and safe water as temperatures drop below freezing point. Displacement keeps growing. Some 3.7 million people remain displaced inside Ukraine, and nearly 6 million are refugees. This year alone, more than 122,000 people have been newly displaced, mostly women, children, and older people from the oblasts on the front lines. Humanitarians are doing what they can to deliver assistance wherever access and security allows. Between January and September of this year, the UN and our partners reached more than 4.2 million people, including 800,000 children. As the Ukrainian winter deepens and the attacks continue, our message is familiar, but increasingly urgent. Civilians, civilian infrastructure, humanitarian staff, and medical personnel must be protected. Children must be shielded and protected. There really isn't any valid excuse not to. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Jens. Okay, we'll take questions now. Yes, Olivia.
Thank you, Jens. With this uptick, at least in the past few days, of you know, nationwide strikes, civilian infrastructure being targeted. I'm just wondering how now that is maybe complicating your efforts from a humanitarian sense. I mean, you're saying there are about 10,000 food parcels being destroyed, and you're saying about the kind of urgent need for action, essentially. But I'm just, yeah, if you can maybe give an impression of whether you feel like, from a humanitarian point of view, you are entering kind of a next stage or a next chapter when it comes to just how difficult it might be becoming to safely deliver much needed aid across Ukraine.
As I said in the beginning, there seems to be, it's getting increasingly worse, right? We see attacks on our convoys. We see attacks that hit our warehouses. We see the infrastructure that civilians depend on being attacked, it seems, systematically. As you heard recently, the humanitarian coordinator there talked about what looks like energy terror, as he named it, right? So these things, heating, water supply, power, and so on, is being systematically attacked. We saw that last year, last winter as well. It seems to be worse this time. And that kind of, the bottom goes out of the response, because there are so many more people who are affected, right? Increasingly. So while we, of course, focus very sharply on those on the front lines, because they're really in a bad spot, the rest of the country is also hit, and that's why we talk about these air alarms, air sirens that goes off all the time. As you know, when you are in Ukraine, there are these rockets that fly over the head all the time. You have no idea where they're going to hit. But when they do, they hit civilian infrastructure, and that's really a major problem.
Further questions in the room? Online? No, I don't. Yes, Taha.
Thank you. I have a question. It's not related to the topic. I hear that the Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, John Fleischer, he will be giving a press briefing for the, I think, ambassador here in next Tuesday in Rome 11. Is it correct? Could you confirm that?
It has nothing to do with the press, so I'm not involved in that.
Yeah, I think if we have anything to update, we'll inform you, but there's nothing that we can confirm here for you at this point. Any other questions perhaps on Ukraine before we release Jens? No, there is a question. Okay, Gabby Proceso. I think this is on Ukraine, Gabby.
No, it's not on Ukraine, but are you going to, is there someone of human rights there?
No, I don't see that they are connected according to the schedule, but in that case, if it's specifically for them, I would just encourage you to liaise bilaterally with them, Gabby. Okay? I'm afraid they're not connected to this call. And that note, I think, and maybe John, is this a question for Jens?
Yes, it is actually.
Okay.
I came in a bit late. I didn't hear correctly. Is it Undersecretary General Fleischer that will be briefing the diplomats next Tuesday in Geneva? And if that's the case, it would be nice for Mr. Fleischer to brief the Geneva Press Corps, given he's given many briefings to the UN colleagues in New York virtually in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I hear it too. Thank you.
Here. Okay, points taken. We'll discuss afterwards. Further questions for Jens before we release him from the podium? Or Gabby, is this, if this is on the same point, maybe we could, unless it's another issue.
It's
go ahead, Jens. Gabby.
Yeah, it's for Jens.
Okay.
On Ukraine. So did you see talks between a president of USA and of Ukraine have a little impact on your work, or it's not? I mean, is you don't have any advance after that meeting? Thank you.
I think you answered your own question. I don't have anything. I think Stéphane Dujarric yesterday in New York had a short comment on that.
I can certainly echo, you know, repeating what we've been saying for quite a while now. I mean, indeed, firstly, this plan that you're alluding to, we're not part of this. We haven't seen it as far as I know. I mean, of course, we stand ready to support any effort for an unconditional ceasefire, for peace and stability in the region. So this is what we've been saying since day one. Of course, it has to be in line with the UN Charter, respecting international law, and of course all UN resolutions. So this is our, what Stefan said yesterday, and this is what I'll repeat here today. So Gabby, I see your hand is still up. Is that a follow-up? Did you not put it down?
Yes.
Okay,
go ahead. Thank you. Do you have communication with the president of Russia?
I need to. We're in touch with Russian authorities. I don't know which level of those contacts are, but I can certainly inquire and get back to you, Gabby, on that. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think you're released, Jens. Thank you very much for the update. And thank you for joining me here, Catherine, who has an announcement from UNCTAD. So I'll leave it to you to announce.
Oui, bonjour à tous. Je vais parler en français, mes notes seront en anglais. La CNUSED vous présentera mardi matin à 9h45 dans cette salle, donc avant le briefing, son dernier rapport sur la situation économique dans le territoire palestinien occupé. Et elle appelle dans ce rapport à une reconstruction de toute urgence. Ce rapport s'intitule « Évolution de l'économie du territoire palestinien occupé » et chiffre à l'appui, le rapport fait état d'un effondrement sans précédent de l'économie palestinienne avec de graves conséquences sociales et environnementales. En Cisjordanie, la contraction de l'économie est très forte et à Gaza, c'est un effondrement très important que l'on constate. L'ensemble de l'économie palestinienne est soumise par ailleurs à des pressions budgétaires et à des contraintes institutionnelles. Tous ces éléments seront détaillés dans la conférence de presse. Bien sûr, je suis sous embargo jusqu'au début de cette conférence, donc je ne vous donnerai pas plus de détails. La CNUSED étudie la situation et l'évolution de la situation économique et sociale dans le territoire palestinien occupé depuis maintenant plus de 40 ans et fournit un appui au renforcement des capacités ainsi que des services de coopération technique. Tous ces travaux sont menés, bien entendu, en partenariat avec les organismes des secteurs publics et privés et la société civile, selon des axes que sont la facilitation du commerce, les capacités productives et le développement institutionnel. La CNUSED œuvre également en faveur d'un consensus international sur les besoins des Palestiniens et de leur économie. Au podium seront le secrétaire général adjoint Pedro Manuel Moreno, le coordinateur du programme d'assistance au peuple palestinien mené par la CNUSED, Moutassim El Agra, et l'économiste au sein de cette équipe du programme d'assistance, Rami Alazeh. Voilà, rendez-vous mardi à 9h45 dans cette salle. Je vous envoie le dossier de presse dans l'après-midi, enfin en début d'après-midi. J'attends la version arabe. Nous aurons tous les communiqués et le rapport dans les 6 langues des Nations Unies. Voilà, merci beaucoup.
Merci. Merci beaucoup, Catherine. Question pour Catherine? Non, c'est clair. Thank you very much again. So indeed, we do have this press conference, as just mentioned by Catherine. One more for me to announce. This one is at 9:45 on Tuesday with colleagues from UNCTAD. Also on the 25th, Tuesday that is, we have a press conference with the executive director of UNAIDS, Winnie Byanyima, World AIDS Day 2025, Overcoming Disruption, Transforming the AIDS Response is the title of their flagship report for this year. It will be launched at 2 p.m. on Tuesday the 25th. That's press conferences. Also wanted to mention a couple of meetings taking place here in Geneva. The Committee Against Torture, as we've been saying, is underway. On Monday afternoon, there will be meetings speaking to the issue of reprisals. Very important issue indeed, colleagues. In other words, speaking out for those who testify and are often threatened for speaking out on human rights issues. So a very important issue that will be addressed by the Committee Against Torture. Also, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is concluding this morning its review of the report of Sweden. And just to keep you on track, colleagues, our Secretary General, Mr. Antonio Guterres, is currently in Johannesburg, where he will be attending the annual G20 summit, as he does every year. As you know, it's South Africa is hosting this year's meeting. It's taking place this week in the 22nd and 23rd. We will share with you the statements that Mr. Guterres will be delivering. There are three different addresses we expect. One is on inclusive and sustainable economic growth. One is titled A Resilient World, the G20's Contribution, Disaster Risk Reduction, Climate Change, and Just Energy Transitions and Food Systems. Quite a long title. Third is on A Fair and Just Future for All, dealing with critical minerals, artificial intelligence, and decent work. So lots of important subjects being addressed through the Secretary General. And of course, while he is in Joburg, the SG will be holding various bilateral meetings. We'll do our best to share readouts with you. After South Africa, the Secretary General will be off to Luanda, Angola, to participate in the seventh session of the African Union European Summit. So that, I don't have the specific dates, but I believe that's Monday, Tuesday next week. And of course, we'll keep you abreast of those developments. And today's World Television Day. So I just want to shout out to our colleagues in the booths there from UNTV and to all you other TV broadcasters, just to mention that today, the 21st of November, is World Television Day. So that's it from me. Any questions, comments from you in the audience online? Nope, that's not the case. So I wish you a nice afternoon, good weekend. See you here Tuesday.